Thank God. Just mothballed in warehouses or that big desert graveyard at A-Mark. Long-term investment, they called it. That's the one thing you can always depend on. As we're fighting one war, we're always preparing for the next one. Our airlift capacity, at least the organization, was almost left intact.
Almost?
The Globemasters had to go. So did anything else powered by a gas-guzzling jet. That left us with prop-powered aircraft. I went from flying the closest thing to an X-wing fighter to the next best thing to a U-Haul.
Was that the main mission of the Air Force?
Airborne resupply was our primary objective, the only one that really counted anymore.
She points to a yellowed map on the wall.
The base commander let me keep it after what happened to me.
The map is of the wartime continental United States. All land west of the Rockies is shadowed a light gray. Amongst this gray are a variety of colored circles.
Islands in the Sea of Zak. Green denotes active military facilities. Some of them had been converted into refugee centers. Some were still contributing to the war effort. Some were well defended but had no strategic impact. The red zones were labeled offensively viable. Factories, mines, power plants. The Army'd left custodial teams during the big pullback. Their job was to guard and maintain these facilities for a time when, if, we could add them to the overall war effort. The blue zones were civilian areas where people had managed to make a stand, carve out a little piece of real estate, and figure some way to live within its boundaries. All these zones were in need of resupply, and that's what the Continental Airlift was all about. It was a massive operation, not just in terms of aircraft and fuel, but organization as well. Remaining in contact with all these islands, processing their demands, coordinating with de-stress, then trying to procure and prioritize all the materiel for each drop made it the statistically largest undertaking in Air Force history. We tried to stay away from consumables, things like food and medicine that required regular deliveries. These were classified as DDs, dependency drops, and they got a backseat to SSDs, self-sustaining drops like tools, spare parts, and tools to make spare parts. They don't need fish, Sinclair used to say. They need fishing poles. Still, every autumn we dropped a lot of fish and wheat and salt and dried vegetables and baby formula. Winters were hard. Remember how long they used to be? Helping people to help themselves is great in theory, but you still gotta keep them alive. Sometimes you had to drop in people. Specialists like doctors or engineers, people with the kind of training you just can't get from a how-to manual. The Blue Zones got a lot of special forces instructors, not only to teach them how better to defend themselves, but to prepare them for the day they might have to go on the offensive. I have a lot of respect for those guys. Most of them knew it was for the duration. A lot of the Blue Zones didn't have airstrips, so they had to parachute in without any hope of pickup. Not all those blue zones remained secure. Some were eventually overrun. The people we dropped in knew the risks they were taking. A lot of heart, all of them.
That goes for the pilots as well.
Hey, I'm not minimizing our risks at all. Every day we had to fly over hundreds, in some cases thousands of miles of infested territory. That's why we had purple zones.
She refers to the last color on the map. The purple circles are few and far between.
We set these up as refuel and repair facilities. A lot of the aircraft didn't have the range to reach remote drop zones on the East Coast if in-flight refueling assets weren't available. They helped reduce the number of ships and crews lost en route. They brought our fleet survivability up to 92%. Unfortunately, I was part of the other 8. I'll never be sure what exactly brought us down. Mechanical malfunction or metal fatigue combined with weather. We were on a hop from Phoenix to the Blue Zone outside Tallahassee, Florida. It was late October, almost full winter back then. Honolulu was trying to squeeze out just a few more drops before the weather socked us in till March. It was our 9th haul that week. We were all on tweaks, these little blue stims that kept you going without hampering your reflexes or judgment. I guess they worked well enough, but they made me have to piss my kidneys out every 20 minutes. My crew, the guys, Used to give me a lot of grief, you know. Girls always having to go. I know they weren't really putting the hate on, but I still tried to hold it as long as I could. After 2 hours of banging around in some seriously heavy turbulence, I finally broke down and turned the stick over to my co-pilot. I just zipped up when suddenly there was this massive jolt like God had just drop-kicked our tail, and suddenly our nose was dipping. The head on our C-130 wasn't even really a toilet, just a portable chem pot with a heavy plastic shower curtain. That's probably what ended up saving my life. If I'd been trapped in a real compartment, maybe knocked out or unable to reach the latch. Suddenly, there was this screech, this overpowering blast of high-pressure air, and I was sucked out right through the rear of the aircraft, right past where the tail should have been. I was spiraling out of control. I could just make out my ship, this gray mass shrinking and smoking on its way down. I straightened myself out, hit my chute. I was still in a daze, my head swimming, trying to catch my breath. I fumbled for my radio and started hollering for my crew to punch out. I didn't get an answer. All I could see was one other chute, the only other one that made it out. That was the worst moment right there, just hanging helplessly. I could see the other chute, above and north of me by about 3.5 clicks. I looked for the others. I tried my radio again, but wasn't able to get a signal. I figured it had been damaged during my exit. I tried to get my bearings, somewhere over southern Louisiana, swampy wilderness that seemed to have no end. I wasn't sure exactly. My brain was still misfiring. At least I had sense enough to check the bare essentials. I could move my legs, my arms. I wasn't in pain or bleeding externally. I checked to make sure my survival kit was intact, still strapped to my thigh, and that my weapon, my MEG, was still jamming me in the ribs. I unclasped my chute. They teach you not to waste time concealing it, and headed in the direction of the other chute. It took me a couple of hours, splashing through this cold slime that numbed everything below my knees. I wasn't thinking clearly, my head was still spinning. No excuse, I know, but that's why I didn't notice that the birds had suddenly beat it in the opposite direction. I did hear the scream, though, faint and far away. I could see the chute tangled in the trees. I started running, another no-no, making all that noise without stopping to listen for Zack. I couldn't see anything, just all these naked gray branches until they were right on top of me. If it wasn't for Rollins, my co-pilot, I'm sure I'd have been a goner. I found him dangling from his harness, dead, twitching. His flight suit had been torn open and his entrails were hanging, draped over 5 of them as they fed in this cloud of red-brown water. One of them had managed to get its neck entangled in a section of small intestine. Every time it moved, it would jerk Rollins, ringing him like a fucking bell. They didn't notice me at all. Close enough to touch and they didn't even look. At least I had the brains to snap on my suppressor, thank God. I didn't have to waste a whole clip another fuck-up. I was so angry. I almost started kicking their corpses. I was so ashamed, so blinded by self-hate.
Self-hate?
I screwed the pooch. My ship, my crew.
But it was an accident. It wasn't your fault.
How do you know that? You weren't there. Shit, I wasn't even there. I don't know what happened. I wasn't doing my job. I was squatting over a bucket like a goddamn little girl. I found myself burning up mentally. Fucking weakling, I told myself. Fucking loser. I started to spiral, not just hating myself, but hating myself for hating myself. Does that make any sense? I'm sure I might have just stayed there, shaking and helpless and waiting for Zack. But then my radio started squawking. Hello? Hello? Is anyone out there? Anyone punch out of that wreck? It was a woman's voice, clearly civilian by her language and tone. I answered immediately, identified myself, and demanded that she respond in kind. She told me she was a sky watcher, and her handle was Mets Fan, or just Mets for short. The Skywatch system was this ad hoc network of isolated ham radio operators. They were supposed to report on downed air crews and do what they could to help with their rescue. It wasn't the most efficient system, mainly because there were so few, but it looked like today was my lucky day. She told me she had seen the smoke and falling wreckage of my Herc, and even though she was probably less than a day's walk from my position, her cabin was heavily surrounded. Before I could say anything, she told me not to worry, that she'd already reported my position to search and rescue, and the best thing to do was to get to open ground where I could rendezvous for pickup. I reached for my GPS, but it had been torn from my suit when I was sucked out of my ship. I had a backup survival map, but it was so big, so unspecific, and my hump took me over so many states that it was practically just a map of the U.S. My head was still clouded with anger and doubt. I told her I didn't know my position, didn't know where to go. She laughed. "You mean you've never made this run before? You don't have every inch of it committed to memory? You didn't see where you were as you were hanging by the silk?" She was so sure of me, trying to get me to think instead of just spoon-feeding me the answers. I realized that I did know this area well, that I had flown over it at least 20 times in the last 3 months, and that I had to be somewhere in the Atchafalaya Basin. "Think," she told me. "What did you see from your chute? Were there any rivers, any roads?" At first, all I could remember were the trees, the endless gray landscape with no distinguishable features. And then, gradually, as my brain cleared, I remembered seeing both rivers and a road. I checked on the map and realized that directly north of me was the I-10 freeway. Metz told me that was the best place for an SNR pickup. She told me it shouldn't take any longer than a day or two at best if I got a move on and stopped burning daylight. As I was about to leave, she stopped me and asked if there was anything I'd forgotten to do. I remember that moment clearly. I turned back to Rollins. He was just starting to open his eyes again. I felt like I should say something, apologize maybe. Then I put a round through his forehead. Metz told me not to blame myself and no matter what, not to let it distract me from the job I had to do. "Stay alive," she said firmly. "Stay alive and do your job." Then she added, "and stop using up your weekend minutes." She was talking about battery power. She didn't miss a trick. So I signed off and started moving north across the swamp. My brain was now on full burner. All my lessons from the creek came rolling back. I stepped, I halted, I listened. I stuck to dry ground where I could, and I made sure to pace myself very carefully. I had to swim a couple of times. That really made me nervous. Once, I swear I could feel a hand just brush against my leg. Once I found a road, small, barely two lanes, and in horrible disrepair. Still, it was better than trudging through the mud. I reported to Metz what I'd found and asked if it would take me right to the freeway. She warned me to stay off it and every other road that crisscrossed the basin. "Roads mean cars," she said, "and cars mean G's." She was talking about any bitten human drivers who died of their wounds while still behind the wheel. And because a ghoul doesn't have the IQ points to open a door or unbuckle a seatbelt, would be doomed to spend the rest of their existence trapped in their cars. I asked her what the danger of that was. Since they couldn't get out, and as long as I didn't let them reach through an open window to grab me, what did it matter how many abandoned cars I passed along the road? Metz reminded me that a trapped G was still able to moan, and therefore still able to call for others. Now I was really confused. If I was going to waste so much time ducking a few back roads with a couple of Zach-filled cars, why was I heading for a freeway that was sure to be jammed with them? "You'll be up above the swamp," she said. "How are they going to get you?" Because it was built several stories above the swamp, this section of the I-10 was the safest place in the whole basin. I confessed I hadn't thought of that. She laughed and said, "Don't worry, honey, I have. Stick with me and I'll get you home." And I did. I stayed away from anything even resembling a road and stuck to as pure a wilderness track as I could. I say pure, but the truth was you couldn't avoid all signs of humanity or what could have been humanity a long time ago. There were shoes, clothes, bits of garbage, and tattered suitcases and hiking gear. I saw a lot of bones on the patches of raised mud. I couldn't tell if they were human or animal. One time I found this huge rib cage. I'm guessing it was a gator, a big one. I didn't want to think about how many G's it took to bring that bastard down. The first G I saw was small, probably a kid. I couldn't tell. Its face was eaten off. The skin, nose, eyes, lips, even the hair and ears. Not completely gone, but partially hanging or stuck in patches to the exposed skull. Maybe there were more wounds, I couldn't tell. It was stuck inside one of those long civilian hiker's packs, stuffed in there tight with the drawstring pulled right up around its neck. The shoulder straps had gotten tangled on the roots of a tree. It was splashing around, half submerged. Its brain must have been intact, and even some of the muscle fibers connecting the jaw. That jaw started snapping as I approached. I don't know how it knew I was there. Maybe some of the nasal cavity was still intact. Maybe the ear canal. It couldn't moan. Its throat had been too badly mangled, but the splashing might have attracted attention, so I put it out of its misery, if it really was miserable, and tried not to think about it. That was another thing they taught us at Willow Creek. Don't write their eulogy. Don't try and imagine who they used to be. How they came to be here, how they came to be this. I know, who doesn't do that, right? Who doesn't look at one of those things and just naturally start to wonder? It's like reading the last page of a book. Your imagination just naturally spinning. And that's when you get distracted, get sloppy, let your guard down, and end up leaving someone else to wonder what happened to you. I tried to put her, it, out of my mind. Instead, I found myself wondering why it had been the only one I'd seen. That was a practical survival question, not just idle musings, so I got on the radio and asked Metz if there was something I was missing here, if maybe there was some area I should be careful to avoid. She reminded me that this area was, for the most part, depopulated, because the blue zones of Baton Rouge and Lafayette were pulling most of the G's in either direction. That was bittersweet comfort, being right between two of the heaviest clusters for miles. She laughed again. Don't worry about it. You'll be fine. I saw something up ahead, a lump that was almost a thicket, but too boxy and shining in places. I reported it to Metz. She warned me not to go near it, keep on going, and keep my eyes on the prize. I was feeling pretty good by this point, a little of the old me coming back. As I got closer, I could see that it was a vehicle, a Lexus hybrid SUV. It was covered in mud and moss and sitting in the water up to its doors. I could see that the rear windows were blocked with survival gear. Tent, sleeping bag, cooking utensils, hunting rifle with boxes and boxes of shells, all new, some still in their plastic. I came around the driver's side window and caught the glint of a .357. It was still clutched in the driver's brown, shriveled hand. He was still sitting upright, looking straight ahead. There was light coming through the side of his skull. He was badly decomposed, at least a year, maybe more. He wore survival khakis, the kind you'd order from one of those upscale hunting safari catalogs. They were still clean and crisp. The only blood was from the head wound. I couldn't see any other wound. No bites, nothing. That hit me hard, a lot harder than the little faceless kid. This guy had had everything he needed to survive. Everything except the will. I know that supposition. Maybe there was a wound I couldn't see, hidden by his clothes or the advanced decomposition. But I knew it, leaning there with my face against the glass, looking at this monument to how easy it was to give up. I stood there for a moment, long enough for Metz to ask me what was happening. I told her what I was seeing, and without pause, she told me to keep on going. I started to argue. I thought I should at least search the vehicle, see if there was anything I needed. She asked me sternly if there was anything I needed, not wanted. I thought about it, admitted there wasn't. His gear was plentiful, but it was civilian, big and bulky. The food needed cooking, the weapons weren't silenced. My survival kit was pretty thorough, and if for some reason I didn't find a helo waiting at the I-10, I could always use this as an emergency supply cache. I brought up the idea of maybe using the SUV itself. Metz asked if I had a tow truck and some jumper cables. Almost like a kid, I answered, no. Then what's keeping you, she asked, or something like that, pushing me to get a move on. I told her to just wait a minute. I leaned my head against the driver's side window. I sighed and felt beat again, drained. Metz got on my ass pushing me. I snapped back at her, shut the fuck up, or something. I just needed a minute, a couple of seconds to, I don't know what. I must have kept my thumb on the transmit button for a few seconds too long because Metz suddenly asked, "What was that?" "What?" I asked. She'd heard something, something on my end.
She'd heard it before you.
I guess so. Because in another second, once I cleared my head and opened my ears, I began to hear it too. The moan, clear and close, followed by the splashing of feet. I spun around, brought up my weapon. I saw six at first, coming at me from all directions, and behind them were another 10, 15. I took a shot at the first one. The round went wild. Metz started squawking at me, demanding a contact report. I gave her a head count, and she told me to stay cool, don't try to run, just stay put, and follow what I'd learned at Willow Creek. I started to ask how she knew about Willow Creek when she shouted for me to shut up and fight. I climbed to the top of the SUV. You're supposed to look for the closest physical defense, and started to measure ranges. I lined up my first target, took a deep breath, and dropped him. To be a fighter jock is to be able to make decisions as fast as your electrochemical impulses can carry them. I'd lost that nanosecond timing when I hit the mud. Now it was back. I was calm. I was focused. All the doubt and weakness were gone. The whole engagement felt like 10 hours, but I guess in reality it was more like 10 minutes. 61 in total. A nice thick ring of submerged corpses. I took my time, checked my remaining ammo, and waited for the next wave to come. None did. It was another 20 minutes before Metz asked me for an update. I gave her a body count, and she told me to remind her never to piss me off. I laughed, the first time since I'd hit the mud. I felt good again, strong and confident. Metz warned me that all these distractions had erased any chance of making it to the I-10 before nightfall, and that I should probably start thinking about where I was going to catch my 40. I got as far away from the SUV as I could before the sky started to darken, and found a decent enough perch in the branches of a tall tree. My kit had this standard-issue microfiber hammock. Great invention. Light and strong and with clasps to keep you from rolling out. That part was also supposed to help calm you down, help you get to sleep faster. Yeah, right. It didn't matter that I'd already been up for close to 48 hours, that I'd tried all the breathing exercises they taught us at the creek, or that I'd even slipped two of my baby L's. You're only supposed to take one, but I figured that was for lightweight wussies. I was me again, remember? I could handle it, and hey, I needed to sleep. I asked her, since there was nothing else to do, or think about, if it was okay to talk about her. Who was she, really? How'd she end up in this isolated cabin in the middle of Cajun country? Metz told me, again, that there would be plenty of time later for an episode of The View. Right now, I needed my sleep, and to check in with her at dawn. I felt the L's kick in between check and in, and was out by dawn. I slept hard. The sky was already light by the time I opened my eyes. I'd been dreaming about, what else, Zach. His moans were still echoing in my ears when I woke up. And then I looked down and realized they weren't dreams. There must have been at least 100 of them surrounding the tree. They were all reaching excitedly, all trying to climb over each other to get up to me. At least they couldn't ramp up. The ground wasn't solid enough. I didn't have the ammo to take all of them out, and since a firefight might also buy time for more to show up, I decided it was best to pack up my gear and execute my escape plan.
You had planned for this?
Not really planned, but they'd trained us for situations like this. It's a lot like jumping from an aircraft. Pick your approximate landing zone, tuck and roll, keep loose, and get up as quick as you can. The goal is to put some serious distance between you and your attackers. You take off running, jogging, or even speed walking. Yeah, they actually told us to consider this as a low-impact alternative. The point is to get far enough away to give you time to plan your next move. According to my map, the I-10 was close enough for me to make a run for it, be spotted by a rescue chopper, and be lifted off before these stink bags would ever catch up. I got on the radio, reported my situation to Metz, and told her to signal SNR for an immediate pickup. She told me to be careful. I crouched, I jumped, and fucking cracked my ankle on a submerged rock. I hit the water face down. Its chill was the only thing, I think, that kept me from blacking out from the pain. I came up spluttering, choking, and the first thing I saw was the whole swarm coming at me. Metz must have known something was up by the fact that I didn't report my safe landing. Maybe she'd asked me what had happened, although I don't remember. I just remember her yelling at me to get up and run. I tried putting weight on my ankle, but lightning shot up through my leg and spine. It couldn't bear the weight, but I screamed so loud I'm sure she heard me through her cabin's window. "Get out of there," she was yelling. "Go!" I started limping, splashing away with upwards of 100 G's on my ass. It must have been comical, this frantic race of cripples. "If you can stand on it, you can run on it," Metz said. "It's not a weight-bearing bone. You can do this." "But it hurts." I actually said that with tears running down my face, with Zach behind me howling for his lunch. I reached the freeway, looming above the swamp like the ruins of a Roman aqueduct. Metz had been right about its relative safety. Only neither of us had counted on my injury or my undead tail. There was no immediate entrance, so I had to limp to one of the small adjoining roads that Metz had originally warned me to avoid. I could see why as I began to get close. Wrecked and rusting cars were piled up by the hundreds, and every tenth one had at least 1 G locked inside. They saw me and started to moan. The sound carried for miles in every direction. "Don't worry about that now," Metz shouted. "Just get on the on-ramp and watch the fucking grabbers."
Grabbers?
Some of the cars had open or broken windows. Even though the G's were belted in, they could still reach for me if I got too close. On the open road, I at least had a chance of dodging them, but on the on-ramp, you're hemmed in on either side. That was the worst part by far, those few minutes trying to get up onto the freeway. I had to go in between the cars. My ankle wouldn't let me get on top of them. These rotting hands would reach out for me, grabbing my flight suit or my wrist. Every headshot cost me seconds that I didn't have. The steep incline was already slowing me down. My ankle was throbbing, my lungs were aching, and the swarm was now gaining on me fast. If it hadn't been for Metz. She was shouting at me the whole time, "Move your ass, you fucking bitch!" She was getting pretty raw by then. "Don't you dare quit! Don't you dare crap out on me!" She never let up, never gave me an inch. "What are you, some weak little victim?" At that point, I thought I was. I knew I could never make it. The exhaustion, the pain more than anything, I think. The anger at fucking up so badly. I actually considered turning my pistol around, wanting to punish myself for, you know. And then Metz really hit me. "What are you?" she roared. "Your fucking mother?" That did it. I hauled ass right up onto the interstate. "Okay, I made it," I reported to Metz. "Now what the fuck do I do?" Her voice suddenly got very soft. She told me to look up. A black dot was heading at me from out of the morning sun. It was following the freeway and grew very quickly into the form of a UH-60. I let out a whoop and popped my signal flare. The first thing I saw when they winched me aboard was that it was a civilian chopper, not government search and rescue. The crew chief was a big Cajun with a thick goatee and wraparound sunglasses. "Where the hell you come from?" he asked. Sorry if I butchered the accent. I almost cried and punched him in his thigh-sized bicep. "You guys work fast," I said. He shot me a look like I didn't know what I was talking about. It turned out later that this wasn't the rescue team, but just a routine air shuttle between Baton Rouge and Lafayette. I didn't know at that moment, and I didn't care. I reported to Metz that I got my pickup, that I was safe. I thanked her for everything she'd done for me, and so I wouldn't really start bawling, I tried to cover with a joke about finally getting that episode of The View. I never got a response.
She sounds like a hell of a skywatcher.
She was a hell of a woman.
You said you had your suspicions by this point.
No civilian, even a veteran skywatcher, could know so much about what goes into wearing those wings. She was just too savvy, too informed, the kind of baseline knowledge of someone who had to have gone through it herself.
So she was a pilot?
Definitely. Not Air Force. I would have known her. But maybe a squid or a jarhead? They'd lost as many pilots as the Air Force on resupply hops like mine, and 8 out of 10 were never accounted for. I'm sure that she must have run into a situation like mine, had to ditch, lost her crew, maybe even blamed herself for it like me. Somehow she managed to find that cabin and spent the rest of the war as one kick-ass Skywatcher.
That makes sense.
Doesn't it?
There's an awkward pause. I search her face, waiting for more.
What?
They never found her.
No.
Or the cabin.
No.
And Honolulu never had any record of a Skywatcher with the call sign Mets fan.
You've done your homework.
Well,
You probably also read my after-action report, right?
Yes.
And the psych evaluation they tacked on after my official debriefing?
Well,
it's bullshit, okay? So what if everything she told me was information I'd already been briefed on? So what if the psych team claim my radio was knocked out before I hit the mud? And so the fuck what if Metz is short for Metis, the mother of Athena, the Greek goddess with the stormy gray eyes? Ah, the shrinks had a ball with that one, especially when they discovered that my mother grew up in the Bronx.
And that remark she made about your mother.
Who the hell doesn't have mother issues? If Metz was a pilot, she was by nature a gambler. She knew she had a good chance of scoring a hit with Mom. She knew the risk, took her shot. Look, if they thought I'd cracked up, why didn't I lose my flight status? Why did they let me have this job? Maybe she wasn't a pilot herself. Maybe she was married to one. Maybe she wanted to be one but never made it as far as I did. Maybe she was just a scared, lonely voice that did what she could to help another scared, lonely voice from ending up like her. Who cares who she was or is? She was there when I needed her. And for the rest of my life, she'll always be with me.
Part 6. Around the World and Above. Province of Bohemia, the European Union. It is called Kost, the bone, and when it lacks in beauty, it more than makes up for in strength. Appearing to grow out of its solid rock foundation, this 14th century Gothic hrad casts an intimidating shadow over the Plakanic Valley, an image David Allen Forbes is keen to capture with his pencil and paper. This will be his second book, Castles of the Zombie War, The Continent. The Englishman sits under a tree, his patchwork clothing and long Scottish sword already adding to this Arthurian setting. He abruptly switches gears as I arrive, from serene artist to painfully nervous storyteller.
When I say that the New World doesn't have our history of fixed fortification, I'm only referring to North America. There are the Spanish coastal fortresses, naturally, along the Caribbean, and the ones we and the French built in the Lesser Antilles. Then there are the Inca ruins in the Andes, although they never experienced direct sieges. Also, when I say North America, that does not include the Mayan Aztec ruins in Mexico. That business with the Battle of Kukulcan, although I suppose that's Toltec now, isn't it? When those chaps held off so many Z-heads on the steps of that bloody Great Pyramid. So when I say New World, I'm really referring to the United States and Canada. This isn't an insult, you understand. Please don't take it as such. You're both young countries. You don't have the history of institutional anarchy we Europeans suffered after the fall of Rome. You've always had standing national governments with the forces capable of enforcing law and order. I know that wasn't true during your westward expansion or your civil war. And please, I'm not discounting those pre-Civil War fortresses or the experiences of those defending them. I'd one day like to visit Fort Jefferson. I hear those who survived there had quite a time of it. All I'm saying is, in Europe's history, we had almost a millennia of living under institutional anarchy, where sometimes the concept of physical safety stopped at the battlements of your lord's castle. Does that make sense? I'm not making sense. Can we start again?
No, this is fine. Please, continue.
You'll edit out all of the daft bits.
You got it.
Right then. Castles. Well, I don't want for a moment to overstate their importance for the general war effort. In fact, when you compare them to any other type of fixed fortification, modern, modified, and so forth, their contribution does seem quite negligible. Unless you're like me and that contribution was what saved your life. This doesn't mean that a mighty fortress was naturally our god. For starters, you must understand the inherent difference between a castle and a palace. A lot of so-called castles were really nothing more than just great impressive homes, or else had been converted to such after their defensive value had become obsolete. Just look at Versailles. That was a first-rate cock-up. Small wonder the French government chose to build their national memorial on its ashes. Did you ever read that poem by Renard about the wild roses that now grow in the memorial garden, their petals stained red with the blood of the damned? Yes, there were cock-ups aplenty. But there were also some noteworthy triumphs. Many were subjected to only short-term sieges, the good fortune of being on the right side of the line. Some in Spain, Bavaria or Scotland, above the Antonine, only had to hold out for a few weeks, or even days. For some, like Kissimul, it was only a question of getting through one rather dodgy night. Then there were the true tales of victory, like the Chenonceau in France, a bizarre little Disney-esque castle built on a bridge over the Cher River. With both connections to land severed and the right amount of strategic forethought, they managed to hold their position for years.
They had enough supplies for years?
Oh, good Lord, no. They simply waited for first snowfall, then raided the surrounding countryside. This was, I should imagine, standard procedure for almost anyone under siege, castle or not. I'm sure those in your strategic blue zones, at least those above the snow line, operated in much the same manner. In that way, we were fortunate that most of Europe freezes in winter. Many of the defenders I've spoken to have agreed that the inevitable onset of winter, long and brutal as it was, became a life-saving reprieve. As long as they didn't freeze to death, many survivors took the opportunity of frozen Z-heads to raid the surrounding countryside for everything they'd need for the warmer months.
Windsor was your castle.
Well, not mine, personally.
I mean, you were there.
It was, from a defensive standpoint, as close as one could come to perfection. Before the war, it was the largest inhabited castle in Europe, almost 13 acres. It had its own well for water and enough storage space to hold a decade's worth of rations. The fire of 1992 led to the state-of-the-art suppression system, and the subsequent terrorist threats upgraded security measures to rival any in the UK. Not even the general public knew what their tax dollars were paying for. Bulletproof glass, reinforced walls, retractable bars, and steel shutters hidden so cleverly in the windowsills and doorframes. But of all of our achievements at Windsor, nothing can rival the siphoning of crude oil and natural gas from the deposit several kilometers beneath the castle's foundation. It had been discovered in the 1990s, but never exploited for a variety of political and environmental reasons. You can believe we exploited it, though. Our contingent of royal engineers rigged a scaffolding up and over our wall and extended it to the drilling site. It was quite an achievement. And you can see how it became the precursor to our fortified motorways. On a personal level, I was just grateful for warm rooms, hot food, and, in a pinch, the Molotovs and flaming ditch. It's not the most efficient way to stop a Z-head. I know, but as long as you've got them stuck and can keep them in the fire. And besides, what else could we do when the bullets ran out and we were left with nothing else but an odd lot of medieval hand weapons? There were quite a bit of those about, in museums, personal collections, and not a decorative dud among them. These were real, tough and tested. They became part of British life again, ordinary citizens traipsing about with a mace or a halberd or double-bladed battle axe. I myself became rather adept with this claymore, although you wouldn't think of it to look at me.
He gestures, slightly embarrassed, to the weapon almost as long as himself.
It's not really ideal. It takes a lot of skill, but eventually you learn what you can do, what you never thought you were capable of, what others around you are capable of.
David hesitates before speaking. He is clearly uncomfortable. I hold out my hand. Thank you so much for taking the time.
There's more.
If you're not comfortable...
No, please, it's quite all right.
Forbes takes a breath.
She wouldn't leave, you see. She insisted, over the objections of Parliament, of the Prime Minister, of her own family, to remain at Windsor. As she put it, for the duration. I thought maybe it was misguided nobility or maybe fear-based paralysis. I tried to make her see reason, begged her almost on my knees. Hadn't she done enough with the Balmoral Decree, turning all her estates into protected zones for anyone who could reach and defend them? Why not join her family in Ireland or the Isle of Man? Or at least, if she was insisting on remaining in Britain, Supreme Command Headquarters north of the Antonine.
What did she say?
The highest of distinctions is service to others.
He clears his throat. His upper lip quivers for a second.
Her father had said that. It was the reason he had refused to run to Canada during the Second World War. The reason her mother had spent the Blitz visiting civilians huddled in the tube stations beneath London. The same reason to this day we remain a united kingdom. They were viewed very much like castles, I suppose. As crumbling, obsolete relics with no real modern function other than as tourist attractions. But when the skies darkened and the nation called, both reawoke to the meaning of their existence. One shielded our bodies, the other our souls.
Ulithi Atoll, Federated States of Micronesia. During World War II, this vast coral atoll served as the main forward base for the United States Pacific Fleet. During World War Z, it sheltered not only American naval vessels, but hundreds of civilian ships as well. One of those ships was the UNS Ural, the first broadcast hub of Radio Free Earth. Now a museum to the achievements of the project, she is the focus of the British documentary, Words at War. One of the subjects interviewed for this documentary is Bharati Palshagar.
Ignorance was the enemy. Lies and superstition, misinformation, disinformation. Sometimes no information at all. Ignorance killed billions of people. Ignorance caused the zombie war. Imagine if we had known then what we know now. Imagine if the undead virus had been as understood as, say, tuberculosis was. Imagine if the world's citizens, or at least those charged with protecting those citizens, had known exactly what they were facing. Ignorance was the real enemy, and cold, hard facts were the weapons. When I first joined Radio Free Earth, it was still called the International Program for Health and Safety Information. The title, Radio Free Earth, came from the individuals and communities who monitored our broadcasts. It was the first real international venture, barely a few months after the South African plan, and years before the conference at Honolulu. Just like the rest of the world based their survival strategies on Redica, our genesis was rooted in Radio Ubunye.
What was Radio Ubunye?
South Africa's broadcast to its isolated citizens. Because they didn't have the resources for material aid, the only insistence the government could render was information. They were the first, at least to my knowledge, to begin these regular multilingual broadcasts. Not only did they offer practical survival skills, they went so far as to collect and address each and every falsehood circulating among their citizens. What we did was take the template of Radio Ubunye and adapt it for the global community. I came aboard, literally, at the very beginning as the Ural's reactors were just being put back online. The Ural was a former vessel of the Soviet, then the Russian Federal Navy. Back then, the SSV-33 had been many things: a command and control ship, a missile tracking platform, an electronic surveillance vessel. Unfortunately, she was also a white elephant, because her systems, they tell me, were too complicated even for her own crew. She had spent the majority of her career tied to a pier at the Vladivostok naval base, providing additional electrical power for the facility. I am not an engineer, so I don't know how they managed to replace her spent fuel rods or convert her massive communication facilities to interface with the global satellite network. I specialize in languages, specifically those of the Indian subcontinent. Myself and Mr. Verma, just the two of us to cover a billion people. Well, at that point it was still a billion. Mr. Verma had found me in the refugee camp in Sri Lanka. He was a translator, I was an interpreter. We had worked together several years before at our country's embassy in London. We thought it'd been hard work then. We had no idea. It was a maddening grind. 18, sometimes 20 hours a day. I don't know when we slept. There was so much raw data, so many dispatches arriving every minute. Much of it had to do with basic survival. How to purify water, create an indoor greenhouse, culture and process mold spore for penicillin. This mind-numbing copy would often be punctuated with facts and terms that I had never heard of before. I'd never heard the term quisling or feral. I didn't know what a lobo was or the false miracle cure of phalanx. All I knew was that suddenly there was a uniformed man shoving a collection of words before my eyes and telling me, "We need this in Marathi and ready to record in 15 minutes.
What kind of misinformation were you combating?
Where do you want me to begin? Medical? Scientific? Military? Spiritual? Psychological? The psychological aspect I found the most maddening. People wanted so badly to anthropomorphize the walking blight. In war, in a conventional war, that is, we spend so much time trying to dehumanize the enemy, to create an emotional distance. We would make up stories or derogatory titles. When I think about what my father used to call Muslims, and now in this war it seemed that everyone was trying desperately to find some shred of a connection to their enemy, to put a human face on something that was so unmistakably inhuman.
Can you give me some examples?
There were so many misconceptions. Zombies were somehow intelligent. They could feel and adapt, use tools and even some human weapons. They carried memories of their former existence, or they could be communicated with and trained like some kind of pet. It was heartbreaking, having to debunk one misguided myth after another. The civilian survival guide helped, but was still severely limited.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. You could see it was clearly written by an American. The references to SUVs and personal firearms. There was no taking into account the cultural differences. The various indigenous solutions people believed would save them from the undead.
Such as?
I'd rather not give too many details, not without tacitly condemning the entire people group from which this solution originated. As an Indian, I had to deal with many aspects of my own culture that had turned self-destructive. There was Varanasi, one of the oldest cities on earth, near the place where Buddha supposedly preached his first sermon and where thousands of Hindu pilgrims came each year to die. In normal, pre-war conditions, the road would be littered with corpses. Now these corpses were rising to attack. Varanasi was one of the hottest white zones, a nexus of living death. This nexus covered almost the entire length of the Ganges. Its healing powers had been scientifically assessed decades before the war. Something to do with the high oxygenation rate of the waters. Tragic. Millions flocked to its shores, serving only to feed the flames. Even after the government's withdrawal to the Himalayas, when over 90% of the country was officially overrun, the pilgrimages continued. Every country had a similar story. Every one of our international crew had at least one moment when they were forced to confront an example of suicidal ignorance. An American told us about how the religious sect known as God's Lambs believed that the rapture had finally come and the quicker they were infected, the quicker they would go to heaven. Another woman, I won't say what country she belonged to, tried her best to dispel the notion that sexual intercourse with a virgin could cleanse the curse. I don't know how many women or little girls were raped as a result of this cleansing. Everyone was furious with his own people. Everyone was ashamed. Our one Belgian crew member compared it to the darkening skies. He used to call it the evil of our collective soul. I guess I have no right to complain. My life was never in danger. My belly was always full. I might not have slept often, but at least I could sleep without fear. Most importantly, I never had to work in the Ural's IR department.
IR?
Information reception. The data we were broadcasting did not originate aboard the Ural. It came from all around the world, from experts and think tanks in various government safe zones. They would transmit their findings to our IR operators who, in turn, would pass it along to us. Much of this data was transmitted to us over conventional open, civilian bands, and many of these bands were crammed with ordinary people's cries for help. There were millions of wretched souls scattered throughout our planet, all screaming into their private radio sets as their children starved or their temporary fortress burned, or their living dead overran their defenses. Even if you didn't understand the language, as many of the operators didn't, there was no mistaking the human voice of anguish. They weren't allowed to answer back, either. There wasn't time. All transmissions had to be devoted to official business. I don't want to know what that was like for the IR operators. When the last broadcast came from Buenos Aires, and that famous Latin singer played that Spanish lullaby, it was too much for one of our operators. He wasn't from Buenos Aires. He wasn't even from South America. He was just an 18-year-old Russian sailor who blew his brains out all over his instruments. He was the first, and since the end of the war, the rest of the IR operators have followed suit. Not one of them is alive today. The last was my Belgian friend. "You carry those voices with you," he told me one morning. We were standing on the deck, looking into that brown haze, waiting for a sunrise we knew we'd never see. "Those cries will be with me the rest of my life. Never resting, never fading, never ceasing their call to join them."
The Demilitarized Zone, South Korea. Hyung-Chul Choi, deputy director of the Korean Central Intelligence Agency, gestures to the dry, hilly, unremarkable landscape to our north. One might mistake it for Southern California, if not for the deserted pillboxes, fading banners, and rusting barbed wire fence that runs to either horizon.
What happened? No one knows. No country was better prepared to repel the infestation than North Korea. Rivers to the north, oceans to the east and west. And to the south?
He gestures to the demilitarized zone.
The most heavily fortified border on Earth. You can see how mountainous the terrain is, how easily defensible. But what you can't see is that those mountains are honeycombed with a titanic military-industrial infrastructure. The North Korean government learned some very hard lessons from your bombing campaign of the 1950s. And had been laboring ever since to create a subterranean system that would allow their people to wage another war from a secure location. Their population was heavily militarized, marshaled to a degree of readiness that made Israel look like Iceland. Over 1 million men and women were actively under arms, with a further 5 in reserve. That is over a quarter of the entire population. Not to mention the fact that almost everyone in the country had, at some point in their lives, undergone basic military training. More important than this training, though, and most important for this kind of warfare, was an almost superhuman degree of national discipline. North Koreans were indoctrinated from birth to believe that their lives were meaningless, that they existed only to serve the state, the revolution, and the great leader. This is almost the polar opposite of what we experienced in the South. We were an open society. We had to be. International trade was our lifeblood. We were individualists. Maybe not as much as you Americans, but we had more than our share of protests and public disturbances. We were such a free and fractured society that we barely managed to implement the Chang Doctrine during the Great Panic. That kind of internal crisis would have been inconceivable in the North. There were people who, even when their government caused a near genocidal famine, would rather resort to eating children than raise even a whisper of defiance. This was the kind of subservience Adolf Hitler could have only dreamed of. If you had given each citizen a gun, a rock, or even their bare hands, pointed them at the approaching zombies and said, "Fight," they would have done so, down to the oldest woman and smallest tot. This was a country bred for war, planned, prepared, and poised for it since July 27, 1953. If you were going to invent a country to not only survive but triumph over the apocalypse we faced, it would have been the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. So what happened? About a month before our trouble started, before the first outbreaks were reported in Busan, the North suddenly and inexplicably severed all diplomatic relations. We weren't told why the rail line, the only overland link between our two sides, was suddenly closed, or why some of our citizens who'd been waiting decades to see long-lost relatives in the North had their dreams abruptly shattered by a rubber stamp. No explanation of any kind was given. All we got was their standard matter of state security brush-off. Unlike many others, I wasn't convinced that this was a prelude to war. Whenever the North had threatened violence, they always rang the same bells. No satellite data, ours or the Americans, showed any hostile intent. There were no troop movements, no aircraft fueling, no ship or submarine deployment. If anything, our forces along the demilitarized zone began noticing their opposite numbers disappearing. We knew them all, the border troops. We'd photographed each one over the years, given them nicknames like Snake Eyes or Bulldog, even compiled dossiers on their supposed ages, backgrounds, and personal lives. Now they were gone, vanished behind shielded trenches and dugouts. Our seismic indicators were similarly silent. If the North had begun tunneling operations or even massed vehicles on the other side of Z, we would have heard it like the National Opal Company. Panmunjom is the only area along the DMZ where opposing sides can meet for face-to-face negotiations. We share joint custody of the conference rooms, and our troops posture for each other over several meters of open courtyard. The guards were changed on a rotating basis. One night, as the North Korean detachment marched into their barracks, no replacement unit marched out. The doors were shut, the lights were extinguished, and we never saw them again. We also saw a complete halt to human intelligence infiltration. Spies from the North were almost as regular and predictable as the seasons. Most of the time, they were easy to spot, wearing out-of-date clothes or asking the price of goods that they should have already known. We used to pick them up all the time, but since the outbreaks began, their numbers had dwindled to zero.
What about your spies in the North?
Vanished. All of them. Right about the same time, all our electronic surveillance assets went dark. I don't mean there was no disturbing radio traffic. I mean there was no traffic at all. One by one, all the civilian and military channels began shutting down. Satellite images showed fewer farmers in their fields, less foot traffic in city streets, even fewer volunteer laborers on many public works projects, which is something that has never happened before. Before we knew it, there wasn't a living soul left from the Yalu to the DMZ. From a purely intelligence standpoint, it appeared as if the entire country, every man, woman, and child in North Korea, had simply vanished. This mystery only stoked our growing anxiety, given what we had to deal with at home. By now there were outbreaks in Seoul, Pohang, Taejong. There was the evacuation of Mokpo, the isolation of Gangneung, and of